Now, in the heady days after 1945, the authority of the USA was unrivaled. But some say 75 years later, there has been a decline in the appeal of the American model. The world has entered a post-American era, defined by the rise of Asia and the return of China, as much as by the decline of the US. Now, there's a new book. It's called Play by the Rules. It's a short history of America's decline. It's the work of Michael Pembroke, who up until this year, for the last 10 years, was a Supreme Court judge in New South Wales. He's now, amongst other things, chairman of Red Room Poetry and has written a number of books. I'm delighted to say Michael Pembroke is on the line. Good to talk to you.
Hello, Luke.
Lovely to chat to you. You always wanted to be a writer, didn't you?
I probably did. It's what I enjoyed doing most in my school days. And then the law seemed to consume me for about 40 years.
Mm. Well, you survived and now you're doing perhaps what you've always wanted to do. Can I just rewind briefly to what I said at the beginning, the idea that we're faced with this choice, or at least this intriguing debate: how do we possibly remain true to our long-term allies, if indeed we should? And that's a question I'll put to you shortly, while still not offending the Chinese such that they support us financially. Is it possible to do both, or have we got to, for want of a better expression, Michael, get with the program?
Well, we can do a lot better, and we just saw a glimmer of hope last week at the AusMin talks when the foreign minister was over there and our defence minister, and there was just a little show of independence when she stood up and said, we don't always agree with the United States and we'll do what's best for Australia. We haven't heard talk like that for a while. Frankly, we didn't hear that from John Howard in 2001 when he agreed to go to Iraq, and we didn't hear it from Harold Holt in 1966 when he coined the phrase "all the way with LBJ." So
yeah.
I'm just a little hopeful that we'll start to be a little more independent than we have been.
You talk about our American past and our Asian future.
I think we have to start to begin to accept that fact. I mean, really, in one respect, it's a function of the weight of numbers and markets. So you've got China, and it's not just China, by the way, it's the whole of East Asia, but China is the biggest. It's got a population which is more than four times that of the United States, and it's got a middle class whose potential has not yet been tapped. And its population is also close to double that of the West. We talk about the West, but Asians don't quite see the West as being the major force it once was. But when you look at the population of Canada and the United States, the UK, Western Europe, Australia and New Zealand, even China's population is close to double of the population of those countries. And when you add in the other countries in Greater Asia, it's a very different equation. And there are some other facts too, Luke.
Yeah.
I wrote about this the other day. The Bloomberg, the American business source, reported last year that China accounted for one-third of global growth. That's been the pattern for the last few years. And the International Monetary Fund projected that by 2024, China's contribution to global growth would exceed 28%, while that of the United States would fall from 13.8% to 9.2%. Now, the recession that we are all experiencing and which will continue for some time will change those numbers, but it's unlikely to alter the trajectory. In fact, I think it'll probably make the disparity greater. So there are a few bald facts that we really have to face up to.
Making America great again is folly, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yes, that's just a populist catch cry to appeal to the Rust Belt base of President Trump. There's nothing serious about that, I don't think.
That opportunity is well past, it would appear. You talk about Hiroshima, which we mentioned on the program yesterday, and I was intrigued to read the chapters about the motivation of the dropping of the bomb. And I think the point you make, it was in fact more about discouraging Russia, because the Japanese are ready to say, righto, we're done here. Have I got that close to right?
Yes, you're right. And I think all serious historians agree with that now. There are probably plenty of Americans who don't, but the reality is that when Truman came to power on the death of President Roosevelt on the 12th of April 1945, he didn't even know about the atomic bomb. He quickly learned about it. He was an old anti-Soviet hater, and he came from a fairly hard scrabble background. And whilst Roosevelt got on with Stalin, Truman never did. And Truman was suspicious of the Russians from the moment he became president. And while the Cold War was looming, Truman very much increased the tempo, and frankly, he militarized it. Now, in August 1945, about 3 or 4 months after he became president, it's clear now from the documents and even some of President Truman's own archival documents that his motivation for using the atomic bombs, first on Hiroshima on the 6th of August and then on Nagasaki on the 9th of August, was to make it clear to Moscow that America had the bomb and was prepared to use it, and Russia should take account of that fact. It wasn't necessary to end the war. Truman went to his grave saying he saved hundreds of thousands of American boys' lives, but six of his leading generals, admirals, and Air Force senior officers, and I've mentioned them all in the book, and this is well documented,
yeah,
all said it was an unnecessary experiment, we didn't need it, Japan would fold within a few weeks and things like that. So it's a very terrible thing, really, because a lot of civilians lost their lives and didn't have to be. And one of the most outspoken later on was the man who became president in 1952, Dwight Eisenhower. He and his brother Milton Eisenhower felt very strongly about what had happened.
According to the Washington Post, you write, there were 72 attempts by the United States to change other nations' governments between 47 and 89. And here we are hearing about all sorts of suggestions about Russia's role in Trump's victory. When you're aware that there were all those attempts by the US, what's your take on the CIA and almost the hypocrisy of some of the modern-day leaders?
Well, there's a lot of hypocrisy, I'm afraid. But, you know, we talk about the Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, but the CIA are and were past masters at interfering in other countries' elections. And they started as early as 1948 in the Italian general election. And that was a major intervention, probably much more substantial than the Russian interference in 2016 in the United States, but a whole lot less sophisticated. It was very blunt, very obvious. A lot of money changed hands. And it set the pattern for the next many decades.
Was there someone who came close to perhaps changing America's direction for the better in your mind?
Well, I have a great admiration for Senator William Fulbright, who was the longest serving chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. George Kennan, who was the architect of containment. General Eisenhower, for what he said more than so much what he did, and they're all dead, of course, but one of the people I refer to is still alive. He's become more of a writer than an army officer. He served in Vietnam. When he left the army, he took up an academic post. That's Andrew Bacevich.
Yeah.
He's written many more books than I have, and they've all said the same thing, but I don't think it's made any difference at all. Washington has steered the same course for 75 years.
So maybe the million or billion dollar question is, has the USA got a way back? Can they be dominant again?
Well, it's very difficult to comprehend, Luke, because I don't see Biden drastically changing course. In fact, I lived in America in 2017, and I wasn't in a bubble like New York. I was in New Jersey and at Princeton. If you talk to people there, they look at things through an entirely different prism, and I don't see much prospect of change. There are some good people, of course, many, many good people, but on the whole, they have a much more militarist culture than we are used to in our country, and they are terrified, frankly, at the prospect that their country will cease to be number one, both economically and militarily. And so they're in a desperate fight now, led by the president, Mr. Pence, the vice president, and Mr. Pompeo, the secretary of state, to hang on to that title of number one. And what worries me and should worry all of us is that at least two of those three gentlemen are true evangelicals. And I say that with great respect to those who have firm views about religion, but yes. Pence and Pompeo are almost on a moral crusade. Trump will do whatever he thinks is in his own interests, but it's a bad situation, I think.
Yeah. There you go. That's Michael Pembroke. The book is Play by the Rules, subtitle, The Short Story of America's Leadership. We haven't been able to do the detail and the analysis justice in the 10 minutes or so we've had together. So I do commend it to you, Michael Pembroke. Great to talk to you, Michael.
Thank you, Luke. It was my pleasure.